This is Remote Ruby.
Have you any remote idea to the meaning of the word?
Yo, 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 yo,
yo.
Yo.
Yo. Yo, yo. Happy Friday.
Yo, yo's. Friday indeed.
Can I get a yo in the chat? Yo.
Hold on. What's going on with your lights, Andrew?
Oh, you noticed. I figured out this thing the other day where I can install an application on my computer and sync it to all the lights in my house to like screen mirror. If I was playing a movie or something, it could like do that. But me personally, I like to turn on trippy YouTube simulator and then fire it all the way up and sit in the dark.
Okay.
Yep.
He's close to having a seizure over there with the flashing lights.
Love it.
So you did your Hanami live stream earlier today.
Yeah.
I just thought we'd jump into that, hear how it went. What'd you build? Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, I had an app called Field Help, which I shut down, but it was just like a knowledge-based system built in Rails. And so I still have that domain. And I was like, let's just build that. It's kind of straightforward-ish. So I don't think we talked about the live stream because I decided to do it last week, but yeah, I just thought, let's build an app. I don't really have any experience in Hanami, and I'll just share my foolishness along the way. So we did that.
Had you used Hanami 1?
I'd used it, but I never shipped anything with it. I'd built an app. I mentioned on the live stream, the thing that tripped me off wasn't Hanami, it was Webpack. I was trying to bring Webpack in to Hanami. So I was probably trying to use, that would have been pre-tailing days I was doing it. But yeah, ended up saying this is too much work. But that's unfortunate because that wasn't Hanami's fault.
Yeah, I think it doesn't matter the framework you're trying to use Webpack with. It's always Webpack's fault.
Yeah.
Very true. Very true.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious because I played with Hanami 1 or whatever a couple times and never really built a full application with it, but I was just kind of curious. I assume a lot has changed considering version 2 took quite a long time. I don't remember when they started development on it, but it's been a while, right?
It's been a few years, maybe a couple, but it feels longer than that. It's cool though, because Hanami brought in Tim Riley and Peter Solnicka, but they're both like dry RB team and ROM. Peter does ROM. So some of those ideas behind like DryRB and ROM made it to Hanami, and kind of the disconnect for me with like DryRB before, and even ROM is, it's hard to like bring those things. It's not hard. It's just maybe a little inconvenient to bring them into a Rails app. You know, it requires a little bit of setup, or Rails already like does something a different way, but it solves the problem. Where like with Hanami, now I get to like experience some of that stuff almost firsthand. Today we were accepting params, and it uses dry schema, dry validation. And the params, you can actually do validations at the controller level, and like that's pretty cool. So yeah, it's cool. I digress a little bit, but it's nice that it's out. And I gotta say, one thing that I think is cool, though I could understand why it might be like a little frustrating, they made the decision to ship 2.0 missing some of the like core components, but they did it so that they wouldn't hold up releasing. Like there is no model layer. They give you instructions in the guides how to connect ROM to it. So we did that today. And they have a view layer they're working on. Tim's been working on it for a while. And so like it wasn't there, but we could bring it in and start using it. That made it a little difficult, but it was actually kind of cool too, because now I understand, still at a surface level, but how those components interact together when they come into Hanami 2.1 early next year.
That is cool, because I know one of the big things they did was, and they've talked about on Twitter or whatever, is like everything's very modular and then auto-loaded and stuff so that you can boot your app up in microseconds or whatever, and it's lightning fast instead of going through the whole Rails' boot process is requiring all the gems and finding the Rails engines and the rail ties and then going through their initializers. And there's a lot that happens when Rails boots. So there's much more on demand or just in time or whatever for stuff, I guess.
It seemed pretty snappy. Cool. Like from, I mean, I was just watching it. Seemed like, yeah, like now that I think about it, it's like, I don't even remember. Because whenever I start Rails, it's like, okay, we got to start this and this and then. Granted, like I usually work in a production application that has other things it boots up too, but that Hanami start command was really quick.
Something else that was cool was when you change like kind of application level settings, like in Rails, those are cached. And so you kill the server and reboot it. I didn't have to do that with Hanami. It's actually like rebooting Puma for you and stuff.
That was so cool to watch.
We made a config change and I was like, oh, I need to reboot the app. And Peter's like, no, try it without. And sure enough, it took on the change.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's one of the things that I don't know how many times all of us have been bitten by that. 20 minutes later, you're like, oh no, I never restarted the server or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, even while Jason was live streaming, like we were running into a bug. And at the very end, I was like, dude, just try restarting the server. Because I think in Rails, I'm just like, so like, okay, nothing else is working. Let's try to restart it. Let's just see, maybe.
One of my favorite features, talking about like app level config, is they have a settings API. And so I set like the settings.database URL. I just basically just say config.database URL. I can tell it what type I expect it to be. And what it's going to do is actually look for a matching environment variable and automatically assign it. So then it's available as config.database URL. And if the type doesn't match, it'll raise an error when it boots.
Whoa, that's pretty cool.
It was awesome.
That dry type at work under the hood, I bet.
Yeah.
The dry gems are so nice. I really like the dry gems. And I have not used them in Rails as much as I've used them in gems and like my Bridgetown stuff. And in there, like it's beautiful.
That's cool.
Yeah, the dry stuff is awesome. They used to have this package. They still have it, but I don't think they're like continuing on with it. It was dry transaction maybe, and it was get ready for all the buzzwords. Basically a way to like write service objects or business logic in like a procedural kind of way. But it was really cool because you could pair it with the dry monads. And so you had steps and it was like, this first step needs to do this. And if it fails, you just say fail and it like breaks out. I think they call it like railway oriented programming. And it was like an API for that. But on the monad part of it, that was cool is when you call the transaction, like the object, you give it a block and you can be like result.success do this, result failure do this. And so you just like pass blocks into those. I just thought that was a cool API for doing that. But
that is cool.
I never just bring that stuff into Rails, maybe because I'm lazy, but today was fun and I'm trying to put myself out there more with stuff I don't know. And so Hanami 2 was like the perfect way into that. And ROM. When we got to like the database stuff, it was like configure your database URL. And I'm like writing a book on Active Record and I'm like, oh, I don't even know how to like compose this.
Yeah. What's a database URL? That Rails supposed to do this for me? Like, wait.
But we made it. We got it. Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. And I got to be a Twitch mod, which was my dream. You made one kid's dream come true today.
We were in there like, we were probably at like the, I don't know, 40 minute mark. And then all of a sudden, like the chat was really active. There was like 450 chat messages. And then midway through, it was like, yo, as a first time streamer, I can like help you get set up and like brand you and all this like stuff about crypto.
Yeah.
Everybody stopped. It was like, boo.
Yeah. And I did the part I had messaged Jason before he started streaming. He didn't see, I was like, dude, mod me because I will protect. And I was like, yep, there it is, dude. Cause I knew it was like, if you're on Twitch long enough, someone will come in with a crypto scam. But the chat was really fun. I mean, several of the core team members were in there. We were figuring stuff out and I had a lot of fun, like not even the coder, like it felt like we were all hacking on something together and it was just cool. A lot of fun energy.
Yeah, it was super cool having Luca and Peter there. I mean, there were a couple of times they'd be like, what am I doing wrong? And they're like, we don't know. And then There was a couple of times they're like, no, do this. And by the time we were done, we had a database table for like knowledge base articles. We had a form for creating them. We had made like a listing of them, the show page, like your basic CRUD stuff. But I don't know, it just felt good to like in a couple hours, even having to configure some of that stuff from scratch, get that shipped.
earlier you mentioned the parameters are done at the controller level. Doesn't Laravel do the same thing?
Okay, so Laravel does do that, where like you can do validations at the controller level. I read a thing the other day where somebody like made a tool that like warned you about doing validations at the controller or something, like you shouldn't in Laravel. So I don't know if that was just like one person's opinion or that's like the community opinion, but yeah, I think it's better personally at the controller level.
Ooh, hot take.
I don't know if I have an opinion, but it seems kind of nice. So I would definitely try it.
The problem I run into is I don't have a specific example right now, but the overall problem I tend to run into is I have a validation in one context, but in a different context, I don't need that validation run. But yeah. The problem is like, so Rails has a thing called validation context. When you call save or create, you can pass it a context. And then in the model, you'd be like, only enforce this validation on this context. Or in your model, you'll do things like ifs or unless on your validations. And I think that in particular is messy. Yeah. And can get kind of wild because you have one model and in a perfect world, it's validated the same. But in theory, in practice, it's probably not. And so then you've got like a bunch of branches of it's validating this state and it's not, where if you could push that up a level to the controller and be like, okay, when I'm submitting this form, I care about this kind of coupling where if you pass in this parameter, okay, well then I need this parameter to be there too. Job board is an example of that. If you say that the job is on site, you got to have a location, an office location. And so the way I enforce that right now is database constraints. I actually have a constraint at the database level. And then, I don't know, it would be nice to enforce that. It's the parameter level. But
I mean, if you've ever had to use the validate false command when trying to save a record, then you probably are feeling some type of way right now. Because, yeah,
it's a great example.
And if you ever even gotten to a place where you're considering that, you know what the problem that Jason's talking about.
You know, if you ever have a complicated process that submitting a request goes through and you have to funnel it to the database first before you can have the types cast correctly, that's just a giant pain. You got to first put it in this object, then typecast, and then you can finally ask, was this true or was it not? And you don't want to be doing active record typecasting on params, whatever option, and doing a different process or whatever. So it does seem like what it would be really nice is almost having them at both levels. So you could do it in the controller and it could do everything there. I do see the benefit of having a form object so you can re-render the form and have the errors available to you when you're rendering the fields out. That's nice, but there is benefit on both levels of having validations there, I think. It depends on what you're doing. Some complicated processes really do need that. And then other CRUD stuff in typical Rails apps, it's fine to do it all in the database level because it's just a form for a specific model, you know, instance. And that's simple and it works great. And it's simple, which is great to teach and show off and everything. There's a lot of complicated things that products need to do too.
There was a conversation about this on Twitter with David Copeland and Matt Swanson, maybe, about Rails validations. I think Matt posted it, but I'd heard DHH talk about this in the past where at Basecamp, they say like, if they can just get by with HTML validations and database constraints and validations, like they'll skip active record ones. And I've tried to do that, but for the most part, it works. Because most of the time your users don't F with a form, right? But like you can take a required validation out of the browser. And the problem is like a not null constraint on the database isn't enough because Rails is going to send that as an empty string. And that empty string is going to be saved as a value because it's technically not null. It's an empty string. And so then like at the database level, it's not as simple as null false. The way I've done it in Jobboardly is I do the required validation on a field, but in the database, I have a check constraint that says it can't be null and it can't be an empty string, which feels like, oh, presence validator is probably what I want there, like on the model. So again, would be nice at a param level to do that, because I wonder if there's a way, like, strip those values with Hanami, where like you can be like, if this isn't here, make it null. It's not filled. Don't make an empty string, because that would solve that problem. And then at the controller level, you could say, hey, this is blank. There's a gem for this for Rails. Somebody has that will like strip empty values.
Yeah, I'm
sure. And that feels, I don't know. I think Raphael's brought this up on Twitter before, but like, I don't know. That just feels like a weird workaround.
You should make a Postgres extension that does it at the database level.
Just, if you give me an empty string, I'm just going to nullify it. I'm sure there are thousands of database admins who just felt like a disturbance in the force by you saying that and are like...
Yeah, you've just attacked a whole group of people.
They're raging right now.
I will say though, for anyone who's listening, it's like, oh, that thing that Jason just said sounds kind of cool, of relying on the HTML and relying on the database, not having the active record. And all I'm saying is that's great and fine if you have all agreed on it and it's not just one person going rogue doing that, because the second I come to it and I don't know that's what's happening, I'm going to change it. And then new people coming in who only know how to do it in Rails and they don't understand. So I'm just saying, like, if you're hearing what Jason's saying, like, oh, this sounds cool, put it in your side project before like starting to do it everywhere in your app without telling anyone.
You could also, if it's okay with your product designer, and at some companies you'd be like, what is that? Where you could actually start embracing HTML validation with like the active records ones. Because in a perfect world, the active record ones, they would never reach there. There's some you cannot do. Obviously, the database has to check on unique constraints, things like that. An active record will do it as well, as long as you're careful. But yeah, I agree. It's a pattern. It's not necessarily the Rails way, even though like the creator of the framework has mentioned they do that. Like Rails validation still exists. But I don't know. I have thoughts on that. Hanami was fun. The model level, speaking of params, the model level was kind of fun. I was planning on just avoiding it today because I knew that it didn't exist yet. And then it was the first thing we did was configure it. Another thing that's cool about it, Hanami, is you can, I guess it's essentially like dependency injection in a way. You have a container at the application level and you can register stuff into it. So what you actually do is when you, and if you're listening, you know what ROM is, it's the Ruby Object Mapper is what it's short for. It is similar to an ORM like Active Record or SQL, in that it is a way to work with a database in Ruby. It's fundamentally very different from Active Record specifically. What you do is you have like a ROM configuration object and you instantiate that and you store that in the container and then you pull it out when you need it. So like in the controller, if we need to access the database, we would include this dependency. We had registered as persistence.ROM and then we'd query articles. But what else was cool about this object is that it was called a relation. So we said like ROM.relation articles. And we could just like reuse it over and over again. So like we loaded that in a Hanami console. We loaded the articles relation. And then I said like to array to give me all the articles. And then we added another one somewhere else. And we came back to the console and we didn't have to reload or anything, because when we said articles to a, it was making another SQL query to reload them, but using the same object, where like in Rails, typically, if we had loaded those articles, it would have saved like a collection of them, not rerun the SQL query. And so it was cool. I don't know, like, even when it came to like finding a record in ROM, I was like, I don't know what to do with my hands right now. But like Peter was there. We figured it out. The view layer stuff is cool. You don't have instance variables. So what you do is when you render the view, you pass it any kind of any objects you want to pass along. So for us, that was articles the first time we used it. And then it's just available as like a regular like variable in the template. So we just said articles.each to and rendered. So it was cool. It's fun.
Yeah, that part was cool. It's going to be interesting to see like what Hanami, whatever version it is that comes out with all that built in, is going to look like.
Yeah. Having the view stuff and having ROM configured, that would have saved us quite a bit of time today.
Yeah.
The view stuff I know Tim has been working on for a while. So today I learned about Tilt.
I done know about Tilt, bro. I can tell you all about Tilt.
Tilt was cool.
Tilted right now.
Roman was saying like, use Tilt, use Tilt.
Yeah.
And then Peter was like, oh, let's use Tsunami View, which is built on Tilt. Because I almost brought Hamill into that thing.
I was like, wait, there's a chance?
Things got weird.
It's our time, boys. Let's go to the chat. But
then I brought ERB in.
Well, the only reason I know about Tilt is because that's what Bridgetown uses under the hood to enable other languages like Hamill and Slim. So I was like, oh, okay, I know. But there was also, we had to bring in a separate gem for ERB, which I thought was interesting. And yeah. I thought your joke about that, though dry, made me laugh. It made me laugh a lot.
Thanks. That's the problem with live streaming is I dropped a couple and it was like, I don't know if anyone got those or they just like are leaving now.
Right.
If you go to this ERB gym, it's like next
generation.
Yeah, next generation ERB. And it's like last commit 4 years ago.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It made me chuckle.
But it was fun. Hanami was fun. It was really cool that like the creators showed up and were like involved with people in the chat answering questions I couldn't answer because I could barely build an app.
Yeah. It felt like a community event. That small vibe of like people just hacking on stuff. Like I said earlier, like there was a lot of really good energy in that chat. And like, I think it was a lot of fun. And I'm sure people who were in that chat, like me too, I was like, I'm going to try Hanami now. Like this makes me want to try it. Just also seeing the creators in there just being like, I don't know if this is going to work. Let's try it. That energy and that attitude is invigorating and it's exciting. And that's the type of attitude and the type of people I want to work with. And so if that's what they've got going on over there, then maybe that's something that I want to check out.
Yeah. I think the only reason Tim wasn't there was because he was asleep.
Yeah. Understandable, I guess.
I had a chat with Tim Tuesday, Wednesday night, and it was 7:30 for me, which was at night, which was 12:30 in the afternoon for him. But we talked about Hanami. And one of the things I told him that I want to cover, I want to keep live streaming. The slices, I think, are really cool. They have this concept of slices that are just multiple apps within one Hanami app. And I keep harping on my side project, but like Podia could be an example of we have multiple slices.
Yeah, we could. Because
we have storefronts for our creators. Their customers have their own logins. We have a backend for our creators to manage their storefronts. We have our own admin. Like that's four slices. And typically the way that's done in Rails for me has always been like, oh, I namespace at the top of the app controllers level. And that's how we do it at Podia. We have like our CMS and our, I don't know what we call it now, storefront. And it works, but you know, it just still feels like one big app where I think the slices is interesting because you can isolate some of that code. And this is again too, where like having params at the controller level with slices, because each one's a different context. And so for an admin, you probably trust the user. So you let in any kind of attribute and you can do that there. And
yeah, you can really wind up in like pundit hell or can, you know, whatever your layer of choosing. Like I've worked on application and I love that Podia is not like this because it's a true nightmare when you have like all these different levels of users and like these different layers of your app and like certain things can accept certain other things and like you just get into this nightmare situation.
Yeah, Elixir has like Umbrella, or maybe it's Phoenix. No, it's Elixir. They do like Umbrella apps. So you can have like multiple apps in one Umbrella project. It kind of reminded me of that.
Whether US East 1 is down or you forgot to add a configuration file, everyone has an outage from time to time. When your next outage occurs, transparency is critical. The difference between a minor annoyance that people soon forget and a fiasco that creates sustained resentment is in how you communicate. That's why you need Honey Badger. Honey Badger will be a crucial component of your incident response plan with their uptime monitoring service that now has an exciting new feature, public status pages. Create a new status page with custom domains, branding, and more. Don't let Twitter be the only way your users can find out if your app is down. Sign up for Honey Badger to improve your incident response with a shiny new status page that you will be proud to show your users. Visit honeybadger.io and start giving your users a better experience today and let them know Remote Ruby sent you. Thanks to Honey Badger for their continued support of Remote Ruby.
The other thing that reminded me of Elixir and Phoenix was we were working with Rob and we were creating a record. We used a change set.
Yeah.
And that was different. Change set's basically like an object or a data structure that's basically like an intent of what you want to do in the database. And then you commit that intent to it. So it was really simple though. It was just dot change set. First argument was a create symbol. And the second one was the params, and we committed it.
And that might have been my first introduction to that in the concept of database. Like, I've heard of change set in other contexts, but I've never seen that before. That was really interesting.
It was cool. It's the first time I'd really used one other than going through like the Ecto guides for Phoenix.
Right.
The other thing that wasn't necessarily a surprise, because I'm familiar like with the concept of ROM, but was like the first time we went to render an article title in the view, I wanted to be like article.title. And I was like, wait a second. When we saw it earlier, that database row was a hash. And so Peter was like, change, I think it was auto struct was the argument, the class method we called. And what it did was basically when you have an instance of that ROM object, it creates a struct. So then anything that is a value like title, ID, you can access with a dot syntax instead of as a hash. But I think there are, at least with Hanami model, you had like a repository and then the model, and like the repository did the actual like database interactions, and the model was basically kind of like a value object. I don't know if ROM goes to all that, but we'll figure out.
Yeah.
The more we keep doing this.
Next time.
Sorry to rehash all this, but if you weren't there.
Hash.
Sorry to restruct all this.
Struct. He said the thing.
But yeah, I also didn't record it by accident. So
now you have a Twitch VOD.
Bruh. Yeah.
There's an option. And
no, you didn't turn it on.
Yeah, I didn't know. I thought it just was automatically on. Yeah.
When you modded me, I turned on like spam filtering stuff. I'm like, wait, you didn't turn this on either. Like, no moderation against certain words that we would definitely not want to show up in the chat. I'm like, I turn that on. Don't want that.
I signed up for Twitch like 2013. I logged into Twitch for the second time this morning, so...
You missed a lot of lore. I am of the Twitch people right now. I'm poggers. I'm very poggers.
All I know is you told me what command to make you a mod, and I just did it without thinking. I was like, here we go.
Yeah. Well, I got you back. I got you back, Jack. Crypto scammers be tripping.
But something else that we didn't have time to do, but like CSRF protection... wasn't documented. When I built my form, it was just an HTML form because I didn't assume there were any like form helpers available. And we didn't have to pass a CSRF token, and it like committed. So Peter said next time we'll figure that out.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
I think it's promising. Again, I think it's cool they released 2.0, even knowing they couldn't ship with like models and views, which at first I didn't know the view thing until we started the stream. But like we made it through. I respect it because it's the ultimate ship quickly.
I respect it completely. I'm like, I would not have done that. And the fact y'all did, that's cool because I wish I could be like that. It's inspiring behavior. Yeah. Good for them. I mean, anyone who's listening to this or anyone who's on that stream, like I would definitely encourage you to check out Hanami. Like we're saying like there's more features coming, blah, blah, blah. But like I learned something today while watching Jason's stream. Jason learned, I'm sure, some things while doing this. So nothing else. It was a great like way to like get out of Rails for a little bit, get back into like more Ruby. And I feel like you could definitely learn some things. So now that Hanami 2 is out, pick it up, start learning some stuff, start trying it out. You may love it.
Yeah. So that was fun. I think next time we pick up, there's still a lot more stuff to do because I want to build a full app in it, start to finish. It'll take a while, but I want to handle like authentication. I want to handle assets, which... is where I gave up last time.
Right.
We're in a, not fully, but a lot of people have moved into a post Webpack era. And
I don't know how accurate that is. I feel like a lot of people want to. I feel like there are a lot of really loud voices on Twitter saying they have. I don't think the majority of people have moved off Webpacker. Well, if they even moved onto it.
I'm saying
Webpack. Oh, you're saying Webpack.
Yeah.
I don't know. Webpack has a lot of mind share out there.
So does Vite, especially within like the Vue community.
And certain communities, but I think Webpack is ubiquitous across everything, right?
I agree.
WordPress still uses it, but it's still the power of half the web.
I'm not saying it's gone away. I'm just saying there's a lot more options out there now that are
increasingly better ones. Yeah.
And they're accepted.
Yes.
Vite's very well accepted, and Parcel has a ton of support. So
right.
I think there's options for me to try and ship even a modern-ish asset pipeline through there, even without it being like Ruby supported.
Yeah, 100%.
But I won't do Webpack.
Oh, no.
You're like a Webpack stan.
No, you got to respect the OGs, you know?
Really? Because you hate jQuery.
No, I never use jQuery, and I am bothered that I have to. I had to use Webpack. Like, I learned Webpack in college. I wrote Webpack in college.
The argument was it. You've used it and you support the OGs.
I respect Backbone.
Have you used Backbone?
Nah. OG.
Oh my God. You're so confusing.
I confuse myself.
Your lights have turned red and so is my face. Well, like I am infuriated right now.
Don't try to figure it out, because if you try to figure it out, I'm going to have to start paying you, because my therapist, you know, it's like there's a whole thing. It requires a professional degree.
Oh Lord. Well, we got 15 minutes before.
Well, we shipped something.
Has a hard
start. Something dope at Podia. Tell me you. Oh yeah, because you haven't been around. You've been missing. Absent. Went to get milk. But now he's back. We have been working on some like really advanced and cool filtering and segmentation options in our audience table. So if you are a Podia creator, you have a table with all of the people that are signed up for your courses across all your products. And we wanted to introduce like a lot more filtering, a lot more segmentation, a lot more power to that table. And we did it all with Turbo, all Turbo. And it's very interactive. I'm impressed with it. I'm proud of it. We ran into some weird things with Turbo. We're like, okay, well, how do we solve this? And we ran into some bugs. And like, as Turbo was upgrading, we were literally, okay, now we can like switch off this branch and we can go back here. And like, I think we really pushed the bounds of like what people are doing or at least talking about with Turbo. And like, we found a lot of really cool things along the way and found some new patterns. And I don't know, if you're a Podia creator, you should check it out. I'm proud of it. It's cool.
That's awesome. That was you and Mario, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, not just us, but on the front end part.
The front end part.
Yeah, yeah. All back in was Harry and Pedro. Like the very beginning, like when all the starting, the very first task was like, all right, we have this table. It's using Cable Ready. It's using Stimulus Reflex. It's using the same thing that we use on a lot of our tables. And we want to make some changes to it. We want to add infinite scrolling. We want to remove the pagination. We want to do some other things. So the first thing is like, let's refactor this table and see what we can do with Turbo. So I did that first. And then that kind of just started this long cycle for the past few months of like continuing to add more and more Turbo on top of it, adding like these advanced tagging options where like I can click on a dropdown, it opens a form, and these are all Turbo streams. Like the page isn't refreshing and you're adding things in the bar of all the tags, and these advanced filters you're making is updating and changing in real time, and page doesn't refresh, and it works very well, I think.
Yeah, it's cool. I got to see the end of it. And it was impressive.
Yeah, you came in to save us at the very end with like this tiny little thing that we couldn't quite figure out. Related to like Turbo action executing, we were opening a dropdown. And when you click a certain thing inside the dropdown's contents replaces with a form potentially. And if you hit discard or save on the form, then we reset the Turbo frame and you're back to where you were, where it's just back to a dropdown with a list of whatever in it. But what we realize is when you click outside of it, thus closing the dropdown, you wind up in this weird spot where the frame hasn't been changed. So it's still sitting there, and we wanted it to flip back to be the dropdown. So you helped us figure out some stuff with that, which was good.
Y'all did all the work.
Yeah. I mean, the other really cool thing that got, you know, as Turbo was upgrading, like we were changing and refactoring, and the finished code got much cleaner. Like it started off as what I thought was a train wreck, and then we really like improved it over time. But when the custom stream actions came out, Mario figured this out, which was, it turned out to be like something we leveraged throughout the whole project of basically, he created a custom stream action where you use it. And so in a Turbo stream, you use this custom, or in your Turbo response template, you put in this thing and it triggers a JavaScript event, the event that you have given to the name of it. And then it can pass in a payload, and then you can pass in a target. So like if you want to target it on a certain element, like you pass in an ID or like the reference to that element, or if you don't pass in anything, it'll just execute on the window. And so what this allowed us to do is, like, as all these different controllers, all these different actions are executing and they're updating turbo frames and all these things, we are able to, like, execute JavaScript events from those streams to be able to say, like, okay, well, when this edit action finishes, like, we want to, like, update these frames. And we also want to send this JavaScript event to tell the form to, like, do this thing, or to tell, like, the card to change, or to do whatever. And we ended up leveraging that a lot, and it worked out really well for us, because then we could basically say, we have a top level container and Turbot, we have all these custom events that get triggered throughout different actions that you can just hook into a stimulus controller. And now you can get a lot finer grain control of what's happening in the DOM as these turbo streams are executing.
Rules. I love it.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, we've been going pretty hard on Turbo the last year or so. And probably over the next couple of years, we'll probably move most of our Sudoist Reflex to Turbo, because it's been a good pattern for us.
Yeah. I mean, there's some things like I would still do with Sudoist Reflex. Like, they can work together, obviously. So you don't have to pick one or the other if one of them does a better thing. But Nate's still pumping on Turbo Ready, texted me today, and he was like, yo, tomorrow morning, I got some stuff to show you. So we need to get him on the podcast to talk about that. I know someone actually emailed me and said they wanted to hear Nate come on. So I'll have to ask him about that tomorrow. But Turbo is working out really well. I will say, though, that we ran up against so many walls, so much frustration. Mario and I were commiserating. We wanted to throw computers. We wanted to throw temper tantrums. It wasn't all sunshine, roses, and easy Turbo work. It was hard, and we bumped up against a lot of stuff, and we had to make a lot of really hard decisions, and we had to come up with, like, patterns that we haven't heard anyone else talk about. It was some uncharted territory, but at the end of it, like, we did it. The big conversation at the beginning of this project was, do we need to use Turbo or do we need to use React? And I'm like, I don't know how to write React. So if we have to do this in React, I'm going to have to learn React. And I don't want to do that. No offense. I don't want to. Like, I don't have to. So I already know Rails. I'm like, let's just write this Rails. I can do it. We can do it. And we did it. So,
yeah, I'm going to go back to your earlier point. You can use Reflex and Turbo together, but I feel like for us, it's really better for us if we just, like, adopt one paradigm and push it as much as we can. I feel like Hotwire has been maybe conceptually easier for people who haven't worked with either before. It has less, it still has maybe the same amount of moving parts, but I've been really happy with it. I think some of the stuff we do with, like, Sudoist Reflex and Cable Ready can be moved to, like, Turbo Ready.
Yeah, 100%. So,
but that's cool. I love it. I'm glad you've shipped it.
Yeah, me too. And it's not broken. It works. Not. We found one really edge case bug with it that we fixed, like, within an hour or two. So far, it's so good. I'm very happy with it.
It's awesome. And I guess over the next few weeks, you and I will transition to moving a soft Webpacker.
Yeah.
To ES build.
Yeah. I wish December was longer. So I guess for context, like, we're doing a hack month, December, because it's a short month and everyone kind of checks out at some point anyway because of the holidays. So we're doing a bunch of tech improvements, which I'm so excited for. Like,
tech the halls.
Yeah, tech the halls. I can't wait. No company I've ever worked for has done this, and I've always wanted to do it. Yeah, Jason and I are going to be doing some stuff. There's so many things I want to do. Like, I have a graph of how I'm going to refactor all our GitHub actions. It's beautiful. And some other stuff that we're going to do. So yeah, we're going to do some of that, do some hacking.
Yeah. We have one hack that was converted to ES build. It's been in production for a couple of months. I ran into some issues Andrea and I did when we were trying to move one of the other packs over. We did some dynamic imports, and ES build does not work well with that. Mostly it was around, like, icons and in React. So what we do is, when we set the props server side for, like, icon, we would just try and, like, lazy load it in JavaScript by just saying, like, building a string to go find it. And Webpacker could do that. ES build cannot. So I had to define all the possible icons we could use, import them, and then basically just build a data structure. So it'd be like icon for this string, and then it can map it together. So it's just like little edge cases like that. But overall, like, the React we have renders with ES build, for example, like, our messaging's built in React, and that was one of the packs we shipped. Was the, like, backend one. So overall, it's been a pretty successful process. We got SAS out of Webpacker It's not an ES build. It's its own CSS bundling SAS command. And that alone improved our Webpacker development speed, not having all the SAS right in there. It's a lot faster. I'm still really happy with the CSS and JS bundling approach over the historical ones.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll run into some more problems. I'm really excited to move us off because saving a JavaScript file rebuilds an ES build in development in like under a second. And
it's pretty nice.
It's worth it.
Yep. It'll be fun to do some pairing.
Well, Chris, sorry we took over the episode. Thanks for coming to the Jason and Andrew show.
I enjoyed listening to it. I'll be curious to hear if you guys end up replacing any of your stimulus stuff with the new Outlets API or like the key binding stuff. Those are two pretty sweet new features and stimulus that came out this week, last week. Yeah. I don't remember.
Within the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Shout out Harry and Andrea because that upgrade got added to our code base. So we can now take advantage of that.
Oh, nice.
And the way they did it was Harry got mad enough one day to just go through and replace all the data target deprecation warnings by fixing them, which was like the only blocker we had to upgrade. But we probably had hundreds, if not thousands, of old target references. So shout out Harry.
Yeah. He put in some work. He put in some hours. Like,
shout out Harry for your anger at deprecation warnings.
Because I was right behind him, though, because I literally had it written down in my notes, like, I got to get rid of these damn deprecation warnings. So annoying. But shout out Harry. He's the really
nice.
Yeah, I want to use that stuff. And apparently Chris and I got challenged to write a front-end view in Hotwire to put it up against the React view. Guess we'll be doing that.
Yeah, I didn't look at the example yet. It'll be cool. I think that's a lot of people's question is, here's something that I got to build and what's going to be easier, doing it in React or is Stimulus going to be hard or Turbo? You know, how is it going to work? It's cool to see sort of the, the CSS Zen Garden, build the same thing, but in a bunch of different ways. And I love projects like that. Curious to see what comes out of that.
I have one question before we go. I have a statement and a question.
God, here we go.
I feel like there are two types of developers. Those who absolutely love Tailwind and those who absolutely hate Tailwind.
Here we go.
Would you agree?
I agree. And you know what? Those people who hate it so much and they feel like it's really important that everyone else knows they hate it. It's not that cool, bro. No one's that impressed.
I will say there's some new stuff in CSS I didn't even know about. I learned the other day and I was like, oh, that's really cool. Maybe it's not new, but setting a content attribute from the data attribute on the element was like mind-boggling to me.
I will make a distinction. The people who are like, hey, you don't need to use Tailwind because you could do this in CSS and showing how to do that with CSS. Like Jared has a really cool tool that will like convert Tailwind into like CSS variables. Now that I think is really cool because it teaches people about the new CSS stuff. That I'm down with. But the haters are just like, come on.
There were two threads in Hacker News this past week on the same day. And I was like, cancel my plans tonight. I'm going to read this. There is no in between. This has its pros and this has its cons. It was just like, this is the worst. Or like, this was made by God himself. Mm-hmm. So there is no gray area.
I think a lot of it depends on your experience. And my experience is that working on a team with a massively growing CSS base, I just don't find in modern situations where there people are gatekeeping like the CSS and taking care of it correctly. And so it just always turns into a nightmare. And so, I'm going to pick Tailwind every time.
Yeah, I had a bunch of situations where like I'd be working with other people on consulting projects and we'd need to move this one widget to another page. And the CSS was nested so deeply that it was like, this will only ever render properly on that page. And it was always like, oh, that sucks. So having the CSS much more modular by nature in the HTML, you can just copy and move it and all the styles come with it, which is nice. You can definitely still write custom CSS the same way, but you have to take care to write your CSS well. So it is reusable and modular, and you can have bad habits doing it either way. So
yeah, 100%.
It is what it is, but you got to learn those nuances or whatever.
Context switching is dangerous for me. If I don't have to switch context in CSS, I'm good.
All right, Chris's got to go. We should get someone who loves it, someone who hates it on one day, and just let them battle it out.
Dude,
see you next week.
I'll battle it. Bye. Yo,
we'll get them on, and then we leave as soon as that starts.
Battle bot.
See ya.
Later.